Welcome to the Adventure Podcast and this specialist series, Explore, How to Plan an Expedition, a series created for the Royal Geographical Society. I'm Matt Pycroft, an expedition specialist, filmmaker and photographer, and I've been going on expeditions under various banners for 15 years. I also sit on the council of the RGS. Our final episode of this series, episode 14, focuses on the future of exploration. This is actually a live recording taken in 2022 from the opening event for the RGS's annual expedition gathering, Explore, held each November. This is a panel discussion on the topic of what it means to be an explorer in the 21st century. We talk about the myriad of global challenges facing exploration today, as well as the responsibilities and tasks facing travellers, adventurers and field scientists, and where they overlap or differ. We also discuss if there's anything left to explore. Spoiler alert, there's a lot. I will give a disclaimer that this episode contains some fruity language as some of our panellists get a little excited. Finally, if you're looking for support with planning your own expedition or field research project, then head to rgs.org to begin the journey. Right, let's get started with the final episode, episode 14 of How to Plan an Expedition. On the panel, I'll start right to left, we have Sophie Roberts, who is an author and a journalist. She focuses on travel stories in remote parts of the world with a special interest in literature and history. And many of you, I hope, will know her for her book, The Lost Pianos of Siberia, which is available for sale outside. We have Ollie Steeds, who is an international investigative journalist and broadcaster who embarked on a bit of a career pivot to found Necton, which is a not-for-profit research institute that commits to scientific exploration and protection of the world's oceans. Leo, who I know very well, I've been on many trips with, is a world-class rock climber, mountaineer, and adventurer who is arguably one of the greatest expedition climbers in history.
Yes. Not arguably, he is.
And Dr. Heidi Silvestre, who is a glaciologist and expert science communicator. She leads several expeditions to cold, snowy, icy places every year and recently won the inaugural Shackleton Medal for Protection of the Polar Regions. So that's our panel. Please give them a hand. So, I don't know how this is going to go tonight. I have briefed them to say you're allowed to disagree with each other and you're allowed to get leery, so we'll see how that goes. But it is a mixed panel with mixed experiences and mixed opinions, so yeah, we'll see how we get on. But I'd like to start by doing a little bit of introduction and background to exploration and field work in a way. And I'm going to start by saying explorer is a dirty word, I think, in the modern world. Lots of people are called explorers and named explorers. You can think of all the Instagram celebrities who are called explorers. But often it conjures up this picture, and I recognise the irony before I say this, of white bearded men planting flags in the name of queen or country or whatever it is. But really, it's often been about personal interest. I'm going to take a little risk now and start with a bit of audience engagement. So, outside of my obvious bias, does anybody in this room consider themselves to be an explorer? Right, excellent. That's kind of what I was hoping for. Not many. So the dictionary definition of explorer is someone who travels to places where no one has ever been in order to find out what is there. I have very strong views on that. As we look to the future of exploration and what there is left to explore, I think it's important that we begin to redefine what it means to be an explorer and to explore in these places. Over the course of this evening, as well as discussing the physical and geographical possibilities for future exploration, I want to speak to our panel about how and why we explore and why this matters. And maybe we could even look to try and redefine what an explorer might be. I'm fairly sure we won't arrive at a conclusion, but at least we can get you thinking. So, and then finally, before we crack on, one thing that, and I didn't tell Shane I was going to say this before we started. One thing that the RGS is always talking about and in constant conversation about, which I think is a very good thing, is the balance and relationship between adventure and geography. And personally, I strongly believe that in order to become geographers, conservationists, scientists, and explorers, There needs to be an access point. We need to have that sense of adventure. We need to fall in love with the natural world in order to want to visit it, learn about it, protect it, tell others about it. There has to be that access point. So with that in mind, I'd like to start by talking to Leo. And maybe if you could begin by talking about your introduction to adventure and the transition from local rock climber to traveling to wild places and how that happened.
I have just written a book about that, actually. I grew up in the Lake District, which is a very nice corner of England, just outside the park, and discovered the joy of outdoor adventure early in life. My father wasn't a climber, but he was a keen outdoorsman, and he had a friend who was a rock climber, and I discovered rock climbing quite early in life and found I was good at it. And I'm one of those lucky people who found my purpose in life very early. And I knew when I was 11 years old what I wanted to do with my life, which was climb things. And initially, they were like quite small things in England. And then I discovered the, you know, big part of my life has been spent climbing the tallest cliffs in the world, which happened to be in, most of them are in very remote places and very spectacular places. Half of them are national parks and areas of outstanding natural beauty. Which is sort of coincidental to the fact that they are the tallest cliffs in the world. So I've spent a great deal of my life in these incredible landscapes. It went according to plan. I'm 42 now, so what was that, 30 years? And I've almost constantly been journeying to these wild places to do pretty wild things. But for no good reason, other than really in and of itself, right? The objective was purely to go and climb these rocks.
And do you feel a need to defend that adventure for the sake of adventure?
Well, I do tonight for some reason. generally not, no. I am conscious of the fact that having the privilege, especially these like big budget expeditions where you go to, you know, the end of the world. Like I did a trip a few years ago to the Transantarctic Mountains in Antarctica, which is a very hard place to get to. You have to go via the South Pole.
Sure.
You have to go via the South Pole to get there. That's how hard it is to get there. And not very many people get to do that. So I am conscious of the fact that given this privileged opportunity, perhaps there should be more to it than just shits and giggles of climbing mountains, right? But it needs to be authentic, it needs to be genuine if you are trying to communicate a message. So I'd be very interested to talk to you tonight, Heidi. We've only just met. Because I think phony science is a bit shit. I think if you don't... I'm going to climb that mountain because I want to go and climb that mountain. And like, yeah, it might help me raise finance if I take a few ice samples on the way, but that doesn't feel genuine to me. I do think there is still a space for just shits and giggles. You know, like there isn't a lot of depth other than the fact that you are trying to achieve something which is almost unachievable in and of itself. So I do think there's a platform for that, but I also think maybe I should be doing more with this opportunity. Can you, should I?
But advocacy can also be show, don't tell. And your advocacy for climate is not by saying I want to save the glacier. It's by being in that environment and people going, oh, my God, that exists. So it's, to me, that's, you know, it's the root of good storytelling has always been show, don't tell. And we're beginning to confuse advocacy and activism with the foundations of how stories stick. So I defend your point of view hugely because it's enough. You've got a platform and it's enough to get a whole generation of people who never thought about that part of the world or that mountain spectre in their lives. And then suddenly it's dropped into the life of a 12-year-old boy who's that 12-year-old boy in the Lake District or some other part in the world that's going to care and get to the top of the mountain.
Yeah, and, you know, we're not here to hear my personal stories tonight, but my access point to the world of adventure was Leo's films and then meeting Leo. Without doing that, I would not have gone on to do what I now do. So,
activism has become so hot, which is great, but let's forget that pseudo-activism
is less memorable than true, authentic endeavour. And I find it a confusing moment in time because the sort of Instagram activism around a climate or whatever has completely confused the foundations and integrity of the idea in the first place. So I'm with you.
Good.
No debating just yet. So do you think that in the modern world we're looking, and I'm speaking broadly here when it comes to adventure and the way that people view that online and in the wider world, do you think we're looking at it through the wrong lens? Do we put, you know, you're an Everest summiter, do we put too much emphasis on the Everests and the poles of the world? And if so, what should we be looking at? What is there left to explore?
So, like, the Explorer's Grand Slam, right? No disrespect to anyone who's done it in the audience. And I have learned not to belittle other people's dreams, especially when you start on stage at the Royal Geographical Society. But it's not exploration, right? It's the Explorer's Grand Slam, which, for those of you that don't know, is the original one is the summit of Everest. It's the three poles. It's the summit of Everest. It's the South Pole. It's the North Pole. But that's morphed into this much more achievable version, which is the last degree South Pole, which is where you fly in a plane to 100 nautical miles away from, you know, to 89 degrees south, and you just do the last bit, so you get to be Scott of the Antarctic for a week instead of 2 months. And the same on the North Pole, and it's called the Explorer's Grand Slam. And then that becomes the Seven Summits, which is the tallest mountain on each continent. And then now, more recently, that's become the 14 peaks, the 14 8,000-metre peaks. And in the antithesis of Rogers, it's bollocks, man. It's like, it's not exploration. It's just, you know, it is what it is. And no disrespect to those people that invest a lot of time, effort, and risk to achieve it, but it's not exploration.
It's
total the commoditization of adventure, and it's just about claiming these things. It's almost like buying a product. And I do have disdain for it, and I've written a chapter in my book about Everest, and I've tried not to slag it off too much, but, you know, as the great Doug Scott, who we commemorated here last year, said, high-altitude tourism is what he called it. And that is a more accurate description than exploration. So I think there's way too much emphasis on that end of the spectrum and on the records and on the firsts and on the how quickly people do the 14,000 or all this bollocks, which is it's its own little thing that it is what it is. But it's the verb exploration is being abused in that realm, in my opinion.
And so I'm careful not to use the word exploration here deliberately, but from an adventurer's, rock climber's, mountaineer's perspective, is there anything left to explore?
Oh, yeah, loads. You know, like, in the... So, again, explore is a loose verb, right? And is it internal? Is it external? Is it psychological? Is it physical? You can have that debate till the cows come home. But, you know, in the vertical realm, actually, the real exploration that remains is subterranean and submariner. There are a huge areas of the Earth which are completely unexplored, but they're underground or they're under the sea. but, you know, when you look at a map, you don't see the vertical part, right? So in my realm, in the vertical realm, there's loads of unexplored terrain, and you are filling in the blanks on the map, because on a map, you don't see, you know, the contour lines get stacked up, but there's huge, like, bits of Earth where, back to that dictionary definition, and I've been privileged to stand on parts of the Earth where no one has ever been before. And they're not like random bits of... They're extremely spectacular places where no one's ever been before. So there are still, like, literal places to explore in the vertical realm. Whether that's important or valuable or not is a different argument.
Yeah, one we will probably have in about half an hour. So, you know, coming on to Heidi, it's a nice segue into your origins as a scientist. You know, before you were a scientist, you were exposed to mountains. I think it would be nice for you to talk a little bit about how you accessed this world that you now occupy.
I mean, when I was young, all I wanted to do was this. I just wanted to be in the mountains. I grew up in the French Alps in Annecy. And, you know, I was a kid, I was a teenager, and I was just hiking up and down these mountains. I started mountaineering, but I quickly realized, unlike you, that I wasn't very good at it. And luckily, when I was 16 or 17, I met a mountain guide from Switzerland who was about 70 years old, deep blue eyes, a fascinating guy full of stories. And he told me, you know, some people get paid to be in the mountains. You know, don't overthink it. And some of these people are scientists, and they get to spend their entire lives studying glaciers. And that's how, when I was a teenager, I thought, hey, that sounds like the coolest job in the world, and I'll try my utmost to become a glaciologist. So that's how, you know, adventure can also inspire people to become scientists. And, you know, I wanted to be a glaciologist just to go on adventures, just to go on expeditions. That's all I cared about when I started studying geography and then glaciology. But now, obviously, there's a completely new dimension to being a glaciologist. It's not just about traveling. It's not just about embracing these incredible remote landscapes. We go to these places to bring something back to society. I mean, the changes that are currently taking place in the polar regions in high altitude environments are terrifying. I was just in the Arctic a few days ago, and it's unbelievable what is happening up there. And so now we feel kind of the weight of this responsibility on our shoulders that, of course, we still deeply, deeply love the fieldwork, the expeditions, but we feel the pressure to try to contribute to society in collecting the best possible data.
But what was your... Yeah, I mean, it's fascinating, and I could talk to you for hours and have. I've just spent 7 weeks in Greenland with Heidi, and I don't get bored. But what was it that made you fall in love with ice? You know, I've never met anybody that loves ice quite as much as Heidi.
I mean, isn't it the coolest thing? No? I mean, honestly, it's everything about glaciers is fascinating. To me, it's just their beauty, the deep blue of the ice. I mean, you've heard all about this, the size. But it's also the feeling of just feeling so small next to these glaciers. And I'm sure we're all used to this in the field, but you feel so tiny when you're in front of a glacier that is incredibly powerful. And you know, sometimes I see them as these very old, ancient, you know, kind of books that have recorded past climates. You know, they've been there for a very, very long time, and they have a lot of stories to tell us. And I just love hanging around glaciers. They're not very talkative, but I think they're great. And now, you know, I understand how important they are as well. So it's just so much more than just these beautiful environments. They actually matter tremendously.
Why?
I mean, just to give you a number, but you guys all know this number. If we were to lose all the ice that is on land, so that's Greenland, Antarctica, you were just talking about, all the beautiful mountain glaciers we have, well, sea levels globally would increase by 65 meters. And there are about 700 million people between 0 and 10 meters of elevation on coastlines. So for that very reason, they matter enormously. They're also the water towers of the world. I mean, if you just look at the beautiful glaciers of the Himalayas that are incredible, so fascinating, but 2 billion people depend upon the meltwater from these glaciers. And right now we are running towards almost complete disappearance of most of these glaciers by the end of the century. I'm not talking about the ice sheet, but just mountain glaciers. So yeah, they do matter. And we're truly, as scientists, in a race against time to better understand these changes. And most of the changes happening right now are happening too quickly for our science to be able to catch up. So things that we thought would happen in 70 years, in 80 years' time, are happening today. So it's our responsibility to be better and play catch up with that.
Yeah. And you know, I'm conscious of not labeling exploration and what is there left to explore as this. You know, you don't need to go on a big, hard journey to define it as exploration, but not to be deliberately difficult, but with modern tech and vehicles and transport, you know, surely the Arctic and the Antarctic and glaciers is somewhere that we can easily explore. Surely it's something that can just be done.
Oh, yeah. I wish, Matt. No, it's not that easy. I mean, you would be frightened to see how few data points we have from the polar regions, for example. If we want to talk about Everest, I mean, the first weather station was installed, what, last year on Mount Everest, right?
And it fell over.
Okay, and it fell over. So we're absolutely not there yet. And yes, we have satellites taking pictures of these places every day. Yes, we have better transportation techniques. But we're desperate to get better data from these places. And it's hard, it's expensive, it's dangerous most of the time. And climate change is also making these places more dangerous. But we desperately need data from those places, and we're not there yet. It's still very difficult.
So why are we putting so, not so little effort, but why have we got such a hole in the data?
You know, I think, I mean, I might shoot myself in the foot here, but part of the answer might be that we're not great scientists at communicating about the importance of those places, right? It's not just our fault. Sometimes we're facing big, powerful lobbies that make sure that there's still a lot of confusion about climate change. But, you know, we need to scream loud at the world how important those places are. And that, you know, whatever trip is going there, whatever expedition is taking place in those regions matter because they can bring some data back. It's not just, you know, superficial. Everything, I think everything collected in those places is a bonus for the scientific community.
And so what are the most important, you know, undiscovered, what are the lacking data points that we desperately need from big list?
Yes, I mean, one thing that is super tricky for us, I mean, you guys were talking about the very deep oceans, and yes, that's tricky, but for us, what we're really struggling with is what's happening underneath these ice sheets, underneath these glaciers. The only way we know about what's under Greenland or Antarctica is by drilling holes. So I don't know if you imagine, like, the amount of work this requires just to have one single data point. And why does it matter so much? Because what's happening underneath the ice sheets can completely change the way they contribute to sea level rise. So, for example, if you have water under a very thick ice sheet, water can lubricate the motion of the ice, and the ice can certainly flow faster into the oceans and contribute more to sea level rise. So we often say that, but know more about the surface of the moon than what's happening underneath glaciers and ice sheets, and it's totally still the case today.
And as most of you probably know here, but in case you don't, the average height of the Antarctic plateau is more than 3,000 metres. So that's a big hole if you want to get to the bottom of that. Yeah, but it's difficult. I mean, yeah. 3,000 metres, you know, that's an alpine summit. That's the average height of the ground on that.
And I mean, yeah, that's so true. It's super thick. And it takes sometimes even years to drill through these 3 or 4 kilometers of ice. And the problem is that the ice is constantly trying to close that borehole. So sometimes, I won't name and shame certain countries, but certain countries have like poured kerosene or really thick liquids to make sure that the boreholes will stay open. So it's tricky, yeah.
Yeah, and there's a lot to unpack there, really, if you think about it. So what do we do?
What do we do? I think we have to use all the tools, all the resources, all the people who are planning to go to those places.
All right.
No? I mean, honestly, it's such a struggle for us to get any data point from those places. If you can bring even just a couple of samples, it makes a tremendous difference for us. So please.
Interesting. Yeah, no,
work with us. We're
coming
pretty
around.
So, Ollie, I mean, you know, it's clear that what Heidi's saying is, you know, this is one of the most important places for us to be exploring, doing field work and science on the planet. Do you agree?
Absolutely. I mean, we saw that in evidence under the sea when we were in Maldives with some of my colleagues who are here and in Seychelles recently. And down at 120 metres, you can see the old beach line down there from the old glacial maximum. So 20,000 years ago, the sea level has risen that amount. And if it's got another 65 metres to go, that's 20 stories in a building, I think. And that's what's coming down the tracks. I mean, we know that the the Doomsday Glacier in Western Antarctica is on the melt, and it's named Doomsday for a bloody good reason, one would presume, and that's what's coming down the tracks, as well as the Greenland ice sheet and other things. And of course, that's a major contributor to sea level rise, as is ocean warming. We warm the sea, you warm water, it expands. So you've got these two twin evils, essentially, directed at the ocean, which is our biosphere, the majority of our biosphere, 90-something, 7% or something, where there's life on our planet is in the sea. And as you warm it, it's transforming the environment.
And, you know, on the subject of oceans, how much do we know about them?
I mean, it depends which bit you look at. If you look at sort of mapping, they think it's about 20% that we've mapped to at the moment. One thing that I've been looking at recently is species, you know, when it comes to life in the sea. And, you know, considering the ocean is has 4.4 billion years of our evolutionary heritage in it, and that's where we have in the tree of life. You've got the kingdom, but then you've got phylum, then you get into all the other sort of descriptions of life. There's 34 phyla on Earth, 33 of them are in the ocean, 12 are on land, so there's a bit of a crossover there. But when it comes to species in the ocean, we've discovered about 235,000 so far. We think there's 2 million, maybe there's 10 million. We have no real idea. The problem we have is that this 2019 is the last data point I've got. We discovered, I think it was 2,046 species that year. In 1846, we discovered 2,099. We basically flatlined since 1846, despite a few little inventions along the way. Whether it's imaging, whether it's sequencing, whether it's all these major technological advances. But what I think inspires me with some sort of hope is that you look around and you think about inventions, the things which have progressed, and they're all around us in the most weird and wonderful ways. Look at luggage, for example. We've had bags for a while, and now we've got wheels. But I remember the day when we didn't have wheels on bags. Don't know how many other people remember those days. It wasn't very long ago, right? For some ridiculous reason, it's taken us how many thousands of years to put wheels on bags? We can advance. So that is where, you know, there are extraordinary opportunities for progression, wherever you think they might be. And yes, it's about journeying to the frontiers of knowledge to push back, you know, our understanding. And that is, I think, one of the principles of a form of exploration. There is the physical journey into these environments, which Leo and everyone here does as well. And being able to inspire people with that sense of the natural world. Yes, it's shits and giggles, but it's your inspiration which takes you to those pieces and bring people with you along the journey, which inspires them with a love of the natural world, which will ultimately, hopefully, lead to more people wanting to protect it. So there is a value in those journeys, and it's, I think, a fundamental factor in exploration in itself.
Yeah, and I'm conscious of making sure that this panel isn't some happy, it's all going to be lovely, let's chat about adventures evening. You know, we're staring down the barrel, you know, a storm is coming. I don't think there's anyone in this room who'd disagree with that, and if there is, stick around for the weekend.
But I think that's the key thing that we need to try and unpack, which is, you know, what is the role of the modern day explorer? Because, you know, arguably there's never been a more important time to have people out there on the front lines of the changing planet, because we know what's coming down the tracks. We need to understand it. And we need to be able to tell the story as well. You know, there was a fascinating lecture that was here a few months ago, which kind of threw one big idea as to, do we need more data? Because we know what's happening, right? We've known this for many, many years. The politicians are still not changing the course, the direction which we're going in. This year, we produced more carbon emissions into the atmosphere than we did the previous year, and it's still building. It's not as if we don't have the data for it. We know that we've got all the data. So we need to do something else beyond that. We need to make the data more relevant in society, which is the role of geography and its heart, which is where exploration and geography really, I think, kind of sit together, because geography is essentially, well, we've got some very good geographers here, so please correct me, as I'm sure you will. But it's an understanding of people and the planet. And that's what unites all these amazing names around the room, because, you know, they didn't go to, you know, you don't go to an explorer school. You know, everyone around here probably did something totally different. How many actually study geography, I don't know. But, you know, there'll be glaciologists, there'll be microbiologists, there'll be all sorts of different people, great climbers as well, going out, amazing storytellers, bringing this whole thing to life.
And it's that combination. But at the heart of all of it is actually geography. And we need to determine what makes geography more relevant today in society, because that's where the answers need to be to transform our direction of travel.
But given how little of the ocean is explored, given how lacking we are in data points, I'm going to be deliberately difficult with kindness, what use is there in discovering new species outside of a romantic notion when we could be channeling our efforts towards working out what the hell's going to happen next?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it's one or the other. I think if you look at the value of our biological understanding of the ocean, it's absolutely fundamental. Life in the ocean and the diversity of life in the ocean makes diversity on Earth possible. You just take one little example of its application in medical science, for example, rather than the big things like regulating the planet's climate or regulating the planet's chemistry. That's done through biology and its interaction with its physical environment and its chemical environment. That's how it's all kind of achieved. But from a biological point of view, you look at the frontline drugs for cancer, cystic fibrosis, HIV, AIDS, COVID. They come from animals in the sea. And we've only sequenced a tiny fraction of what's in there. So imagine what else we could discover that could transform the challenges which we have around healthcare, or the new challenges that we're going to have from healthcare. You know, there are tens of thousands of viruses in every single drop of water. What can that tell us to help us come? Anyway, on and on it could go. So yes, there's lots of good reasons why we need to discover what lives in the sea. One of the most incredible finds recently, which blew my mind, was this algae, which, if you feed to cows, reduces their methane emission by 98%. Feed cows seaweed. Can't be that difficult. Sorry.
Can't be that difficult. Let's do that. I think it would be cool as well, there is a little bit of hope required in the room, I'm sure. It would be good for you to tell us about the recent successes at Necton as well.
Yes, I mean, there's something about hope, which I just come back from a week with a friend of mine who has cancer. And we were staying at a place called Hope Cove. And we're talking about this issue about, where are we on the planet? Where are we going? She says that I don't have hope anymore. I want results. That's what matters. And so when it comes to these conversations, whether you're a pessimist or an optimist, whether you're hopeful or not, fine, take your position. But what we need now more than anything are results. Because, I don't think there's much time for hope at the moment, quite frankly.
Yeah, and so what was your transition? You spent the first X portion of your career as a journalist and broadcaster. What led you to transition into what you do now?
Well, it started before that, actually, here in the in the RGS with Shane and Nigel, who Windsor, who are the most probably for many of us in the room, extraordinary inspirations for what exploration means, what geography means, and challenging us to actually go out and redefine it. And I did my first expedition in 98, and it was a terrible fuck-up. I mean, it was my deepest apologies to Nigel and Shane for supporting it. But, it was to investigate the historical grass silk route across Mongolia and China, but, I realised then I really wasn't very good at organising expeditions. We saw your incredible mission up the mountains in the Guyana and the jungles there, that extraordinary logistical operation, without seeming any great drama. I don't know how you pull that off, but it's absolutely mind-blowing. Anyway, I realised I wasn't very good at that. And so I thought I'd better go and learn about the world, so I became a journalist, until I came back to a point where I was sitting at the bottom of the sea and the island of Arran up in Scotland, reporting on this marine protected area where there was this great lush jungle of life behind me, and in front of me was this wasteland where these trawlers had been out for scallops. And literally, you could see the devastation that was there. And it's like getting a massive, great tractor and driving across the countryside, destroying all the trees, destroying all the farms just to scoop up a couple of cows. That's what they're doing. We clear cut about 300 times the amount of seabed as we do on land. And they're doing it in these seamounts, these undersea mountains. It's out of sight and it's out of mind. And they're destroying these undersea Galapagoses. Quite a lot of the work going on in the high seas in this particular area is funded by governments because it's financially unsustainable, which means it's taxpayers' money, which is going into the destruction of nature, a destruction of undersea Galapagoses. And at that point, I was like, oh, for fuck's sake,
we got to do.
People need to know.
People need to know. We got to do more about it. And I didn't know anything about marine science, nothing about a conservation organisation, nothing about submersibles that we use, nothing about any of that, and thought, there's some very clever people around here who know quite a lot about this. Surely we can try and do something to change that.
So I'm conscious of not getting too far down the rabbit hole with this, but given your lack of experience, as you say, how the hell did you do that?
With a lot of help from a lot of brilliant people. Some of them are in the room. Head of marine operations and expedition manager Mike and Denise, who just led them, who are brilliant at what they do. Amazing amount of experience. So Mike's day job, for example, is running a fleet of vessels doing survey work to put up renewable wind farms and things in the east coast of the United States. So he does this on a daily basis. When we come to doing our marine expedition, to bring his knowledge and expertise of marine operations into what we do, we can actually do it. We're not reinventing the wheel. We're just lucky to find people like him who know what they're doing. And it's a combined effort to achieve that. And I think what should give us hope, excuse coming back to the idea again, but you know, if we've been able to do it, and we've discovered two new ecosystems in the past 5 or 6 years, we've just come back from the Maldives, where we discovered a new one a couple of weeks ago. So there is extraordinary things to discover, and once we can see them, and we can tell the story of them, we know they're there, we can help protect them.
Yeah, and I want to go into storytelling, but I'm going to go off-piste, because I can. I was going to save all this for the end, but you know, you spoke there about team and building good teams. I think, put this to all of you, how important, when it comes to being an explorer, whether you're an adventurer, geographer, everything in between, how important is a team?
Absolutely vital. I mean, Leo, from your film yesterday, you had how many people in your team?
It was a small team of highly skilled people. But yeah, you know, great things don't happen individually, do they? We all know that. You don't do this stuff on your own. We need to work with each other and with small teams of skilled people to find the data and tell the stories.
And for you?
For me?
Yeah.
It's all about the people I work with, 100%. I can't concentrate on keeping myself safe, so I have to have that in the room, because I can't look at the back exit when I'm looking at the front, if you see what I mean. And that means safety, security, and an interpreter. The art of the interpreter is profoundly important, because I'm working with people and human stories. And if that person isn't trusted and isn't truthful, you're in all sorts of trouble. So, and it's one of the things that's so fascinating, and when you dig into the archives of this institution, often the interpreters, the conduits, are forgotten. They're never written about. They have no voice. And that's something that is, I think there needs to be more recognition of those conduits and the team. But mine is very different from, you know, Waldo, who ties your ropes. It's a very different art, but it still matters.
And so, you know, just to bring us round to this sort of chapter of the evening, why does communicating a story matter, you know, starting with Sophie?
We're meaning-seeking creatures. Without story, we don't connect. If we don't connect, we don't find empathy and compassion, and without compassion, there's no hope. So it's pretty simple to me that it's about connecting dots.
And so what are the keys to telling a good story in that regard?
To me, it's getting under the skin of the narrative, and people, to my mind, more interesting than places. I started off writing about place, and then I realised the only access point was the people that occupied that place. Whether or not that's Leo at the top of the mountain, I need to know how his head is thinking and feeling in order for me to care about what I'm looking at or experiencing. And it's the same with great science writing. So I don't know how many of you know Suzanne Simard wrote an extraordinary book called Finding the Mother Tree, True Exploration in the Deep, Deep Forests of North America. But she did this brilliant thing of transcending science and geography by finding the human connection. And that's how you remember stories. We love, we hate, we have sex. It's the human stories that connect us and make us remember.
Yeah, and you've spoken a lot to me in the past about the importance of archive and legacy and kind of my language, not yours, but building on the shoulders of giants, you know, why is that so important, and what do we have to do as, I guess, intelligent explorers to make sure that we're, well, looking at what's come before?
Okay. I think exploration in this institution only being a symbol of British history has built on a fairly patriarchal model of command. And that means a commanding environment as well. You know, it's men going into the middle of Africa in the 19th century and claiming to find the source of the Nile. But of course, there was a man living at the source of the Nile who'd already found it. So I think we have to pivot that sort of hierarchy of going in first to discover into thinking the opposite of those. It's changing the sort of ethnocentrism that we have, basically. I mean, I'll never forget this. It was a very important moment. I worked for three years in Siberia. Covers an 11th of the world's land surface. It's not fashionable. It's not Everest, and it's not a pole, but it's massive. And I was using a slightly arcane way to try and get into understanding what it is to be in that part of the world. So I was looking for a piano. I was in the Altai Mountains.
Why were you looking for a piano?
Because I had a friend in Mongolia that needed one.
You can buy the book afterwards to find out.
No, and it was a conceit. But it was a brilliant way to knock on a door. I was working for The Economist at the time. You know, Putin had the devil eyes and the cover, and no journalist could go in and talk about geopolitics in Putin's Russia. But I could knock on the door of a little wooden house in the Altai, say, have you got a piano? And then suddenly, you know, you're in neutral territory and something opens up. And there was this amazing human being. He was called Leonid Koloshin, who had built up a library through just sheer... He was a navigator for Aeroflot and had been for... And he'd been living in this little house for 10 years. He'd built up a library of 10,000 books through... I mean, just amazing, because he believed knowledge is power and all the rest of it. And I said, you know, I'm looking for a piano for this friend of mine. He said, well, if you find one, will you bring me one, because I need one for this concert hall he wanted to build for his community. And I said, oh, come on, Leonid, this is the middle of nowhere. And he looked at me dead in the eye, didn't drop a smile, and goes, this isn't the middle of nowhere. I live in this is the center of everything. Mm. And I suddenly realized that kind of pivot of perspective is, what is it to explore? Pivot your perspective. And then you start again. It's a whole new way of looking at things. So the archive becomes incredibly important, because you can take, as I'm doing at the moment, I took a footnote from a Proceedings of the Royal Geographical Society in 1879, right on the cusp of the scramble for Africa. You take that footnote and you look at it, and it completely pivots the voice you can't hear. The silence says everything. And that is when, to me, I mean, I'm the opposite of a scientist. I work in the more poetic space I'm not looking for resolution. I'm looking for what is puzzling. But I think the two things converge. E.O. Wilson, I'm sure a lot of you know his work, and he wrote a brilliant book, Letters to a Young Scientist. And there's lines in there that are relevant to all of us in geography and science and adventure and in the deep oceans and the poles, which is a single phrase, make use of puzzlement. That is the beginning of exploration of any description, make use of puzzlement.
Yeah, and what you've just said points to a profound colonial arrogance, just in that dictionary definition. Not that I have an agenda here, but someone who travels to places where no one has ever been is literally the definition of exploration.
We need to redefine it. I mean, it's out of date.
Yeah, but it is. But to what extent, and again, I'm off piste here, but, and put this to all of you, should we look back on the past with judgment? I use that word very specifically, you know, Scott, Stanley, Livingstone, Doug Scott, even. Should we look back and think, well, how should we look back at them?
They're men of their times. History is history. They're men of their times. But you have to look at it with the perspective on what your point of view is on that. So, for instance, there's this area of, I'm really interested in the places that other people overlook. You literally fly over. And so what a good example is this area in central Tanzania around the capital, which lots of people don't even know the capital of Tanzania is Dodoma. And that sits in an area called Gogoland. And Gogoland is like, I mean, it's huge, 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 huge area. And if you start looking at records of 1879, because they all crossed it in order to get to the, you know, basically the slave markets of the Congo and the ivory markets of the Congo. If you look at those records, 1879, 1889, 1819, 1902, 1904, through the war records and all the rest of it, you see the most incredible apocalypse of a landscape through the observations of travellers and explorers. So, yes, you know, Burton went in for one motif. Yes, the German explorer went in for another motif. And yes, I've gone in for another motif on top of that. But collectively, there's a message that is bigger than the individual part. I find that really interesting, the sort of layers in history. And that's why, you know, that's why an expedition like Spectre is really super fascinating, because it hasn't got those layers. So it might be the beginning of something where, you know, it might be much easier, God knows how, but in the future, and that becomes the next set of layers of something. And, you know, like you talked about a glacier, it's like a palimpsest. It's like we've got to look at the, got to look down, not always across at things.
Yeah, and I know you well enough to know that you would never define yourself as an explorer, I think, and I'm trying to convince you that you should be.
No, I'm absolutely. It's I'm interested in being a conduit of people that do remarkable things, and that's not me. I'm a conduit. I mean, that's what journalists do. But I think there's a moral responsibility to do that, of course. And I think, you know, I think it's not about being worthy, about what you're going out in the world to do or say, but it is about having integrity and conviction. And without those, you might as well not bother. So that was a bit harsh, wasn't it? But I do think it, and that's where I get impatient with the sort of pseudo-exploration. It's not that one thing is better or worse than another. The person that researches the tiny ant is as valid as the person that goes to the moon, in my view, if it's done with equal integrity and equal authenticity.
Yeah.
I must just say on that, for the audience tonight, that you shouldn't put Doug Scott and Captain Scott in the same category, because Doug Scott, who was a great British mountaineer, who died 2 years ago, and we had a big event here last year to celebrate his life, was way ahead of the game in this post-colonial integrating. There was three of his climbing partners who were Nepalese Sherpa people who were here a few months ago. He climbed with those guys in the 80s and the 70s and spent the last part of his life committed to a charity called Community Action Nepal. So was really like far-sighted on that. Like, it's not an us and them thing. He was way, way ahead of the game on integrating, you know, the people of Nepal into the ascents and calling them by their names and not just referencing them as Sherpa support and, you know, Ang Ferber, who was here. And so I just want to say that, because you really shouldn't get those two Scots confused.
I was hoping you'd bite.
But maybe I can give another example about what is currently happening in the Arctic, for example, where there's a lot of history of colonialism, of course. And right now, pretty much all the research projects taking place in the Arctic are being co-led, co-developed with indigenous communities. And, you know, I'm a scientist. I come from that view of the world, you know, science, but there is an entire different system of knowledge, an entire different worldview from the indigenous communities in the Arctic, who are the true experts of this place, obviously. And I think it's truly about time that us, the scientists, understand the importance of eventually giving them the lead of these projects and making sure that the data we collect in those remote places are not just for the sake of science. It's not just to publish reports or journals. We have to make sure that this is useful for them. So I think it's about time that they really just embrace and empower what they can do also by making sure that their views of the world are being understood and communicated the right way.
Yeah, it's an absolutely critical part of this conversation. You know, the title of this evening is there anything left to explore? The answer is obviously yes, but you already knew that. part of what we've talked about is what is there to explore and why, but I think that how is fundamental to what we do next.
And the who, as you both, yes. as you've all been saying, you know, how critical it is to change that dialogue and redefine what exploration means, because you know, on your expedition, for example, Leo, when you were working with two indigenous guys from Guyana and took them on the mountain, what you learned from the mountain from them was probably a lot more than you learned from Waldo or someone who didn't live in Guyana.
I did an event here last night and we showed a film where we did an expedition to a place called Mount Roraima, which is on the border between Venezuela, Guyana and Brazil in the Amazon rainforest, and it's this incredible tepui, which in the local language is the house of the gods, and these insane rock towers that stick up out of the jungle like something out of a fantasy. And it has been climbed before, but what was unique about our trip is that we journeyed in for 100 kilometres overland through the forest for a week, but the local community, which is called Philippi, and the local indigenous population called the Akawayo tribe, they speak English in Guyana. It's the only English-speaking country in South America, so back to that interpretation dialogue thing, we were able to communicate open and freely in our first languages with one another, and we brought two of those guys up this 600-metre overhanging cliff, which has been conquered by expeditions before, but we shared that journey with them, and it was by far the best part of the trip was to share that. Yeah. You know, we couldn't have got to the base without them, they couldn't have got to the top without us, but it just gave us this other view of the landscape and of the whole experience was to sort of share it with them, and it was actually one of the coolest trips I've ever done because of that, because there was much more depth to it.
Yeah. The obligation is in conceding those layers of knowledge, whether they're indigenous or whether they're in the archives or whether they're other scientists or that have come before. And I think that is something that really has to shift in the way that people disseminate their story. Mm. Instead of trying to be the hero, where there's just the single character that dominates the narrative, there is that recognition, and that is the task of our times if we're going to democratize a filthy word.
Yeah, but also
equity at the heart of the redefinition of exploration needs to be right in there. I mean, our mission in the Maldives, for example, yeah, the story was about the Maldivians taking first descents into their ocean. It's their ocean. They're the ones who can tell us what this means. But it's co-producing the mission from the beginning, or the purpose of the expedition, and saying, well, what do you want? As you mentioned before, I think you mentioned before about the need to co-produce the science or the work which you're doing to ensure that the outcome meets the needs of the people who live there. Fundamentally, and for them to be the story.
It's to co-produce, but isn't it always, and again, this is a really interesting thing, it's also to disseminate. Our biggest problem right now is closed borders, ideological, physical, of every description. And for as long as we contract, the problems we're trying to solve are becoming worse. So disseminating the message of the Maldivians going for the first descent is about also reaching much wider audiences. And that, to me, is a really big challenge, and one that I don't like to be only in the hands of Netflix. It's a fight you have as a writer, and it's a fight you have in any of the various mechanisms that you and we might have to put our message to the world. But you know what I mean? It's like the impact comes in where that story connects, and I think that's what you have to really fight for, don't we?
True, but I think you can do it, and I think, you know, if you, what we need, one of the things we need to do within that context is tell the story differently. We need to find new ways to tell the stories, innovative ways, different voices in different environments, and you know, that's where the power will come, that's what will transform. And if you've got the story, it does get out there. Like our mission to the Maldives, there is over 3,000 different broadcast features and print articles and digital across 100 plus countries around the world. So if you tell the story, there's a story to be told by the voice, particularly the Maldivians, because it's the lowest country on earth, people want to hear it and they need to hear it.
But that would have been effective because it's disruptive of the trope, isn't it? People don't expect their storytelling to have been flipped into the hands of the Maldivians, so that's why it was powerful.
No, I don't think so. I think it was powerful because I don't think anyone really cared whether we had anything to do with it. I don't think that was really what was of interest. What's interest to the audience is what the Maldivians think about this.
Yeah, yeah.
What are they actually doing about it?
And it's Yellow Submarine, right?
Yes, that helps. Yeah. But to get, you know, to innovate the story, we need to find new ways to tell stories. We need to, you know, one of the most powerful things which we've done in terms of disrupting the story was when we did a comedy show underwater. So for your kind of shits and giggles, it's like, yeah, but imagine taking a comedian onto that mountain where you've been and telling the story of that place. But, you know, give the hands, give it over to, yes, a storyteller.
Out of context, kind of.
Yeah, because for a comedian, we need to laugh more about the crisis that we're in. You know, I always find it incredible how Amnesty do their thing with, what's that show that they do with their comedy show for... can someone help me out here?
Secret
Policeman's Ball. There we are, Secret Policeman's Ball. Mixing, human rights and comedy. Who thought that would work? But it does. We need to think differently if we want to make a difference, ultimately. Yeah. And that's in storytelling terms. And that's...
Yeah, I mean, I couldn't agree more. And when it comes to the science, because we're not great at all in communicating science, we need to go so much further than reports, publications. I mean, for sure, this is not enough. I mean, a friend of mine told me that when we give presentations about what we observe, it looks like an accountant just going through numbers, curves going up and down. And who can relate to that? I mean, no one. And the science shouldn't stay within the scientific community. Mm. You know, we need the people in the field. We need the indigenous communities. We need everyone just to tell us what they're seeing. Because I think in order for the science to have an impact, it should be about emotions. It should be about the human stories. It shouldn't be about the numbers. It will never be enough. Right now, it's not working the way we're communicating the science. And we think that by publishing IPCC reports, that suddenly people will get this awakening and be propelled into action and will stop using fossil fuels, but it's not happening. So we need to think differently. And I totally agree. I think humor, which is quite hard to pull off when we talk about the climate crisis, is a great way to do this. And just to name a great media called the Juice Media that is making these super funny videos about the climate crisis, and they're having a great impact. Mm. So perhaps this is where we need to go.
Yeah. They tried with Don't Look Up, but I'm sure people have got strong views on that.
I think it can be really powerful to put the wrong things together that makes the space for exploration, you know? It's like, that's the gap.
Who would you put together then? If you had like a dream scenario to put two odd things in place.
Put pianos in Siberia, because you don't expect a bourgeois big heavy instrument in the middle of an Asiatic land. And my next book is about why four Indian elephants ended up in the heart of the Congo. It's like, why would you have four Indian elephants there? And the wrong thing together creates the opportunity for story. Mm-hmm. You know, I was your spectre. It was like I just didn't expect a mountain in Antarctica. I've been there. You know, I've watched them do Vincent and all the rest of it, but I didn't expect that to be there in that space. And so it's the wrong things in places. So I think it can be very powerful to sometimes break the cliche from the
beginning.
I'm
coming around to the idea of bringing some science into one of these trips, I must say, in the past hour.
Yeah. And a comedian.
Great to hear.
Thank you, comedian.
Yeah, it's going to be quite the cast.
And a piano as well.
Yeah.
Goes a whole hog.
I'm very conscious of time, but I absolutely have to ask you also, it's a silly question, it's an easy question. What is the future of exploration? What makes a modern explorer?
Who's going to take that one first? Go on, Ian.
The last big trip I did, as you've described, we was kind of quite progressive, where we tried to include the local community, and there was I've realised all the big expeditions I've done have been exclusively male because they're all my friends, and I consciously brought a girl along to widen it. But to be honest, the next big trip I do, I want it to be two of my mates with no cameras, and I want to go somewhere where no one's been before and do something that no one's done before and not tell anyone about it just for shits and giggles, so sorry.
But there's something we haven't touched on. We haven't touched on at all with you and what you do, which, you know, you've always phrased it to me as new school style. You know, that's something that you arguably over the last 20 years have been a pioneer for, whether it was, you know, climbing and jumping off, whether it was snow kiting across continents. And you know, really what you're doing is creating this legacy of progression in terms of travel. How do we travel through these places? Which I think is an important point as well.
So that Spectre trip, there's this mountain, the one that you have to go via the South Pole to get to, and it's a giant fang of rock that's 2,500 feet tall, and it's in the Transantarctic Mountains, and it's an unusual granite intrusion in that range. There's not a lot of granite, it's all schist, and then there's this one little, and it's like a crystal, and it looks like a crystal, and the scale is off because it's thousands of feet. It's not like, but there's nothing there. There's no one for thousands of miles in any direction. And then there's this giant thing that looks like a crystal, but it's 2,500 feet tall. And we kite skied for 2,000 miles across Antarctica to get to it. So kite is, your skis and a big kite and long lines and a massive sledge that weighed 200 kilos. And it took 65 days. And there was just three of us. And it was back to that crass phrase, shits and giggles. You know, we weren't collecting ice samples. We weren't communicating that this place is melting. I just wanted to go and climb that mountain. But perhaps next time there is potential, because it is a good story, right? There's like, did you even know you could do that? You can. It's pretty hard. But it is, you can do it. You can travel for thousands of miles. You can do hundreds of miles a day. Top speed was 37 miles per hour. What? You know, like.
Lucky one drinking.
These are potentially hooks for other stories.
Yeah. I'm going to put you on the spot.
You know, but I think it's so important to still have room for expeditions like these. I mean, just to be. That's what you were saying, the puzzlement, be amazed by these environments. It's like Frozen Planet, you know, season two. The first step is to be amazed by these environments. And then eventually you start caring and you want to protect them. So I think it's, you know, there's absolutely no shame in doing these kind of trips. I do that all the time. And I think they're so very important. But to answer your question about what's, you know, kind of the future of exploration for us, the scientists, is also a way. One thing we're being heavily criticized about is the carbon footprint of research. So that's definitely something we have to look into. The new transportation methods, yes, we can be better, we must do better, and we're definitely inspired by, you know, what you've done. Now there are entire expeditions crossing the Greenland ice sheet just using wind.
Right, yeah.
And this is so very important. But also, for us, it's all about the impact of our work. Yes, it's important to collect data in those places, but who cares, you know? Who cares until you make sure that people understand why these places are so important and understand what they can do using their own circles of influence, using their own tools and techniques to create a better future. So for us, I think the next big challenge, the one thing we are yet to explore or explore deeper, is probably the true impact of the work that we do.
Yeah. And I just want to, you know, maybe point this towards that half of the room, but one question I haven't asked, and we will wrap this up, I promise. Is exploration just a physical journey? You know, is it that simple? Does it need to contain a physical element at all?
Well, I would obviously say no. It is. I spent 2 years in COVID able to write and research in this field because I believe that you can go down into the issue before you walk into it. I also need a ground truth. I need to be on the ground. That's just a personal version of my reading of exploration. So each of us
each of us use that word differently. I mean, there's a wonderful, wonderful writer called Sylvain Tesson who went to live for 6 months on the shores of Lake Baikal. And he took no book related to the place he was in. So he took, instead of taking, you know, a Russian writer to Russia, he took Byron. He was deliberately opposite. He had no other person with him for these months and months he spent in a cabin on Lake Baikal. It's one of the most beautiful books of exploration you'll ever read. So it's personal to your voice. It's true to what you believe. And exploration is, the future of exploration will always be what it was in the past, which is to walk bravely, boldly into what confounds you. So it can be any kind, physical, mental, scientific, adventuresome.
Anyone have anything to add on the future of exploration?
Yeah, I mean, I think bringing it back to here, to the Royal Geographical Society, where we've got the names and the history of exploration around us, another way to look at it is to ask, well, who are going to be the names in the future? Because this mob, amazing, inspirational for many of us, define that era. It's up to us to define what the future is. What Doug did, he helped redefine what exploration does, what exploration is in his way, which you now carry on in different ways as well. What you're doing is incredible. Your name should be up here in the future. And, you know, I look at it and think, well, you know, what's going to define our future and where does geography fit into that ultimately? And we know that the two great crises that we face are the climate crisis and the biodiversity crisis. So we need to push back our understanding and we need new knowledge to achieve that. And that does involve physical journeys to ground truth data or to discover new things so we can protect it or to go there to be able to tell the stories. So it's all of those things in a new modern, well, not new, I mean, in a new, far more equitable way. So I think equity has to be at the heart as a key pillar of what the future of exploration is. But we all need to kind of look at it and go, you know, to the people who put their hand up and said, you know, they were explorers already. I think we're all explorers in many ways. We've all got a responsibility to what's happening now. We have a short window of opportunity to affect the direction of travel for the planet for hundreds, if not thousands of years ahead of us. And we've got a short window. Every single one of us can push back the frontiers of knowledge or tell the story in different ways. And that can be a very individual pursuit. So exploration can be an individual thing and what it means to a person or to a community. And it still has value. So I think, you know, that in terms of the future of exploration, it needs to combine all those things. And it needs to be brave and bold to affect the future direction of our planet, ultimately. And that's a responsibility that every single one of us have. Therefore, every single person in this room should feel they're an explorer if they feel that they want to push, you know, they want to change the direction of the planet and ultimately feel that they're a geographer as well. Because as a geographer, you're trying to understand the people and place. That's my final line.
Well done, Ollie.
It's a shame that I now have to close after that. But, yeah, I think, you know, what's quite obvious is that physical exploration and I would say intellectual exploration is alive and kicking. There's no threat there. You know, as I've said many times, the title, Is There Anything Left to Explore? Yes, there is. That's quite obvious. But I think there are other things that I've learned, we've learned, that we're thinking about. The world is changing. It's always changing. We can recover old ground. We can look at it through a new lens. We can reevaluate it, reassess it. And, you know, there's arguably, as has been said many times by people more clever than me, there's more purpose than ever before. We know what we face. We know what is coming. And it is critical that we start to look at it. But equally, whether that's through research, whether it's through poetry and everything in between, all of those things matter. And I would personally argue that people across that spectrum are explorers in some way or another. You know, just a little self-indulgent thing. The best I've ever heard, you know, I run a podcast that centers around adventure and exploration. The best description I've ever heard is that the difference between adventure and exploration is exploration requires us to bring something back for the tribe. Adventure is a journey of self. That's as close as I can get. Thanks for listening. For more information on how to get started with planning your own expedition or field research project, head to rgs.org. This podcast is hosted by Matt Pycroft, produced and edited by Laura Jaycott for Terra Incognita Publishing, and Shane Windsor and Laura Melville for the Royal Geographical Society.